Frieden. Es ist das erklärte Ziel der Menschheit, Kriege und Konflikte endlich zu überwinden oder sie von vornherein zu vermeiden, um in einer friedlichen Welt ohne Gewalt zusammenzuleben. Doch Frieden scheint in diesen Tagen weiter entfernt als jemals zuvor. Hallo, mein Name ist Dominik Holl, ich arbeite für die Union-Stiftung und ich darf Sie herzlich zu einer neuen und außergewöhnlichen Folge von Politik International begrüßen. Zusammen mit der Konrad-Adenauer-Stiftung Saarbrücken, dem Deutsch-Amerikanischen Institut Saarland und dem Deutschen Orient-Institut in Berlin schauen wir alle zwei Wochen auf ein globales Thema. Für diese Folge habe ich mit Stephen Youngblood, er ist ehemaliger Professor für Kommunikation und Friedensschaften, gesprochen. Er hat in Parkville, Missouri, das Center for Global Peace Journalism gegründet. Damit möchte er Frieden fördern, aber auch junge Menschen darin schulen, aus und über Konflikte zu berichten, über Lösungen und Vorschläge für friedliches Zusammenleben. Dabei geht es vor allem um den Fokus, reißerische und zuspitzende Formulierungen zu vermeiden und eine nuancierte Perspektive der in den jeweiligen Konflikten Unterdrückten zu beschreiben. Stephen Youngblood und organisiert und unterrichtet in Seminaren und Workshops in über 44 Ländern. Er ist dreifacher Fulbright Scholar und Autor des Buches Peace Journalism Principles and Practices. Youngblood ist Redakteur des Magazins The Peace Journalist und Verfasser des Blogs Peace Journalism Insights. Alle Links dazu finden Sie in den Shownotes. Seine Arbeit und sein Bemühen um Weltfrieden wurden unter anderem vom US State Department, dem Rotary International und dem World Forum for Peace ausgezeichnet und letztere verliehen ihm den Luxemburgischen Friedenspreis 2020-21. Das Interview mit Stephen Youngblood habe ich auf Englisch geführt. Sie finden aber in den Shownotes einen Hinweis auf das Transkript und wir werden es versuchen, so schnell wie möglich auch ins Deutsche zu übersetzen. Ich danke ganz besonders dem Deutsch-Amerikanischen Institut für den Kontakt zu Stephen Youngblood. Und wenn Sie mehr über das DAI oder die Arbeit des Center for Global Peace Journalism wissen möchten, dann finden Sie in den Shownotes die entsprechenden Links zu den jeweiligen Homepages. Every story has a beginning, has a middle and an end. That's the very basic structure of any story that even kids get when they tell you about their day at kindergarten or at school. But stories are way more than that, and they are way more powerful. I'm happy to talk to Stephen Youngblood, former professor of communications and peace studies. He is the founding director of the Center for Global Peace Journalism in Parkville, Missouri, USA, and he's the director of education for the NGO Making Peace Visible. Hello, Professor Youngblood. It's an honor to have you here.
The honor is mine as well.
Professor Youngblood, let's dive in. What to you is the most fascinating aspect of stories in general? Why are we as humans so attracted by and drawn to stories?
Well, I think it relates to our natural curiosity, that we're curious about the world around us. And I think the nature of compelling storytelling hasn't changed through the years. 2,000 years, whether it was 2,000 years ago around a campfire, or today on social media, that we're looking for stories that are relevant. We're looking for stories that are dramatic or moving. We're looking for stories that are funny. And so I think the nature of storytelling the essence of storytelling hasn't changed for millennia. I think what has changed, of course, is the way that we tell stories and the way that they're delivered.
Mm. You mentioned social media, and as we live in the age of communication, and probably whoever is listening to this is probably texting via WhatsApp right now or swiping through Instagram while listening, nearly all we do in our daily lives is communicating on social media, but also interacting with one another in person. But do we still know, and you mentioned 2,000 years ago, we did this on campfires, it's the basic part of being a human and surviving as a group is communication. But do we still know how to do that, how to communicate properly? Do we still know that?
Well, I think the key word there is properly. I think that I would say properly according to whom. From my viewpoint, as someone who promotes peace journalism and peace media, what constitutes proper is communication that doesn't encourage conflict, that doesn't pour petrol on the fire, that doesn't discriminate and scapegoat, that doesn't encourage or glorify violence. For me, this is where I draw the line in terms of proper communication, whether it's occurring at a professional level from journalists or whether it's occurring at an individual level from people who create and share social media content. Are we contributing to peace or are we contributing to conflict?
Now, as I introduced you, you taught communications for 27 years and also peace studies. But how do these two very different fields of scientific research, how do they fit together? Where do you bring the communication and the peace studies together and combine them to something new?
Well, I think the intersection of communications and peace studies is indeed peace journalism. By definition, peace journalism is when reporters and editors are making choices that can create an atmosphere conducive to peace. So what choices am I talking about? So we're talking about the words that we use. Are these words inflammatory? Are they stereotyping? Are they denigrating? Or are they the opposite? Another choice is how we frame our story. So do we frame our story in a way that it leaves the audience with the conclusion that violence is the only alternative? Are we framing our story in such a way that we're ignoring peace and peace builders? Are we glorifying violence? Are we sensationalizing the story, making a bad situation worse? So that's what peace journalism is. What peace journalism isn't is open advocacy for peace. So we're not promoting peace, but we are talking about peace. We're putting peace on the agenda. We're leading discussions about peace. So in the same way that a war journalist wouldn't be accused of promoting war, the same can be said of a peace journalist, that we're not advocating for peace, but we're putting peace back on the agenda. We're giving peacemakers a voice proportionate to warmongers. And we're not making a bad situation worse. We're not pouring petrol on the fire.
Mm. We will talk more about peace journalism and how you approach this way of journalism more. But you now give seminars and teach journalists all over the world about peace journalism. Before we get into that, have you yourself ever worked as a journalist in a conflict zone, or have you ever written about a conflict of any kind yourself?
Yes, of course. So during my peace journalism trainings and workshops, I've often reported from the places where I've been. And it may be something as simple as a blog. It may be an audio report that aired on regional and local channels, that sort of thing. So, for example, I was in Uganda during a period, in northwestern Uganda during a period of famine. I reported about the famine. I was in South Sudan during a lull in the fighting. During the long war there, I reported about that. I was in Germany and Austria a few years ago, working with journalists on reporting refugees. And I did some reporting there too.
And now you are giving seminars about peace journalism yourself. You're trying to teach this style of journalism. But what's the essence of your seminars? How is the approach towards peace journalism very different, or maybe nuanced different to regular journalism in parentheses?
Right. So I gave you the definition a few moments ago. So peace journalism, I think, at its basis, is really, in large part, just good journalism. And it's a way of refocusing our efforts, I think, towards good journalism. So some of the characteristics of peace journalism include, and I think that this will help answer your question. So some of the characteristics include rejecting us versus them reporting, which I think is prevalent throughout the world, in the U.S. especially, this polarizing political reporting. And instead, peace journalism seeks to build bridges across divides, be they political divides, be they political bound, be they geographical boundaries and so on. So, for example, I've worked for 5 years with Indian and Pakistani journalists, putting them together into reporting teams and having them jointly report issues of common interest. Peace journalism gives a voice to the marginalized. So we're really looking for those in our societies who have been marginalized, ignored by the media, and in seeking to give them the voice that they deserve. For example, in Moldova, where I just finished a 9-month Fulbright scholarship, we did a project on responsibly reporting Roma, because in Moldova and throughout much of Europe, for that matter, Roma are among the most marginalized people. Peace journalists are careful about the language and the images that they use. We talked about that a little bit. Peace journalists talk about solutions, not advocating a solution, but leading societal discussions about solutions. So those are some of the characteristics of peace journalism.
Hmm. This and you mentioned that it's kind of going back to the roots of journalism and refocusing. But how does, can you maybe explain how the media in general works? Because why isn't every journalist automatically a peace journalist as well? I mean, they cover facts. They try to be as objective as can be. That's the ethic high, objective of any journalist, as far as I understand it. Why does it need someone like you to teach peace journalism? And why aren't they all peace journalists from the very beginning?
Well, I certainly think that they should be. But there's a mountain of academic research that shows that they're simply not practicing peace journalism, that so much of the reporting that we get is this polarizing us versus them reporting. We see traditional journalism regarding refugees, for example, that often demonizes, stereotypes, and scapegoats refugees. So it's not being practiced in that domain either. When we look at coverage of things like crime and terrorism, the violence is frequently glorified, sensationalized, highlighted. So while I agree that everyone should be practicing peace journalism, certainly the research evidence shows that that's not the case.
Mm. This research you are mentioning, and you are holding, you're giving your seminars all over the world. Is this research from all over the world as well, or are there certain differences between, I don't know, maybe the United States media or German media or the media in India and Pakistan? So is there a difference in journalism in different countries? And if so, what would that difference be? Or if not, there's no such thing? Question mark.
Well, I mean, absolutely, the media are different everywhere, right? And so peace journalism as a theory is not one size fits all. So as I go through the characteristics of peace journalism, some of these might be more applicable to Uganda than they are to Lebanon, for example. I think the focus of my seminars and workshops, and I've taught in person in 32 countries, the focus is always different because the focus is always local. And I always work with local partners on the thematic issues that they feel are really important. So in Moldova, as I mentioned, you know, probably the main focus has been on peace journalism and disinformation. Since Moldova is right now engaged in a hybrid war with Russia, and Russia is bombarding Moldova with disinformation designed to confuse, designed to promote pro-Kremlin candidates, designed to destabilize Moldova. So disinformation is the key issue there. In the United States, in my opinion, I think that the key area where peace journalism can help or provide some guidance would be polarization in the media. And if you've ever seen Fox News, I encourage you to maybe take a look at it. It's something we do from time to time. I'm usually talking back to the TV and throwing pillows at the TV, but it's important to get that perspective and to look at the ways that media have helped to polarize the American society in places like Uganda with large numbers of refugees. I think that peace journalism's value is in building bridges of understanding between refugees and their host communities. Turkey would be another example of that.
Mm. This is very interesting that you mentioned the United States. That would be my next question as well, because I would very much agree with you that the media in the United States is highly polarized. So at least that's how it's perceived from a German perspective. So
I think your perception is correct.
Yeah, that you have media outlets like Fox News that everybody knows by now, that is on the one side of the political spectrum, and then you have outlets like MSNBC on the very far side, on the opposite side. So this is a wide spectrum, but there's also a lot of in between. So not only looking at the edges of the spectrum, how peaceful in general or not is the media landscape of the United States? Fox News.
Yeah. Well, I would use the word not, because simply you have not only the Fox Newses of the world, but you have all of this corrosive in my view, destructive online discourse that spreads these politically charged themes misinforms, disinforms. I think the perfect example of this is COVID, right? So when COVID happened, I naively believed that maybe this was something that could help to bridge the polarization gap. And as I look back on my thoughts on the subject, I was hopelessly naive. In fact, COVID, it was simply seized as another topic to fuel this polarization. I mean, I never would have thought that there would be so much opposition. Again, this was a naive belief, that there would be so much opposition to public health authorities and public health pronouncements about COVID, that there would be so much opposition to the COVID vaccine. I mean, it was really shocking. And this was opposition that was driven, yes, in part by MAGA forces, but also by the media. I mean, just imagine if we had had this sort of political and media environment in the 1950s. We'd still be walking around menaced by polio. Or earlier in the 1900s, right? We'd all still have smallpox, for goodness sake. And so, yeah, I mean, we can really see in COVID an example that nothing escapes the media polarization grinder, unfortunately.
Another example, now you mentioned COVID, but there are also different conflicts every day. We have the protests at the universities right now. We had the Black Lives Matter movement. And you talk about looking at conflicts from different angles and giving new perspectives that promote peace. So let's take another example. Let's take the January 6th uprising, the storm of the Capitol. How was this event portrayed by the media? And what would you have made different? How would be a peace journalistic coverage be different from what we saw?
So how it was portrayed by the media depends on which media. So on Fox News, these criminals are portrayed as patriots. They're portrayed as supporting the real Constitution, supporting their president, and so on. And on the other media outlets, they're portrayed as the violent criminals that they indeed are. How peace journalism would portray this is, I think, somewhere in the middle. Not ignoring the violence, understanding the violence, articulating the themes from the right that would explain but not excuse the behavior of these people. And I think there is an explanation, and the explanation goes back to media, right? And social media too. So I think we would attempt to explain what happened without glorifying the violence and trying to, well, let me put it this way. I think sometimes as peace journalists, the best that we can do is to not make a bad situation worse. So I think as we report this as matter-of-factly as possible, trying to filter out the political hype from both sides. And I think that's the best that we can do.
Hmm. Let's talk about a much bigger conflict that is an actual war, Ukraine versus Russia. More and more people seem to be tired of the ongoing war, and they're calling for a ceasefire and the start of negotiations, fully aware that would maybe mean the Ukraine losing territory and having Russia as a dangerous threat next to them nonetheless, not knowing when or if they might strike again anytime soon. So is promoting for an immediate peace, no matter what, in such a difficult and complex scenario the right way? And does peace journalism mean peace now, no matter what, in the sense of giving the opponent whatever he wants as long as there's no more war going on? So how would peace journalism work in the case of the Ukraine war against Russia?
So as I mentioned earlier, peace journalism does not openly advocate or promote peace. So that's not our role. Our role is leading discussions about peace. So given that role, then, the way that a peace journalist would approach this is to continually discuss the peaceful alternatives, and in a way that's not. Although I agree with what you said, I would say as a peace journalist, you would be cautious about not being dismissive.
Yeah,
and to continuously lead this discussion about peaceful alternatives. And this isn't happening in the media. I did a small study about a year ago where I looked at thousands of articles in English language media, in European and American media, and found that the sort of violent war terms, things like tank and attack and rocket and victims and casualties and explosions, so on and so forth, that these terms outnumbered peaceful terms, peace, negotiations, treaty, and so on, by a 5-to-1 margin. So it's not the media's job to promote peace, but it's also not the media's job to ignore peace. So a peace journalist wants to keep peace on the table while not advocating for any one solution or peace at all.
But is it always possible to do that? Is it always possible to talk about peace when, I mean, let's go back to 2022 when Russia first invaded the Ukraine. The first few days, nobody thought about this ending quickly, or maybe the Russians thought so that they would be through in 3 days. But after a week, we saw this will go on for a very, very long time, and there will be fighting for the next weeks, heavy fighting as well, and they now need ammo and ammunition, and nobody was talking about peace because it wasn't even it didn't seem possible. So how is peace journalism possible in such an environment where peace doesn't seem possible and nobody is talking about it? So who are you going
to... So that's good. So back to a comment I made earlier. Sometimes the best that we can do is just to not make a bad situation worse.
All right.
To not further incite hatreds on either side, to not glorify the violence, to not glorify the war. Sometimes that's the best that we can do.
I understand. Let's shift our focus to another conflict that is right now carried out in the Levant, mainly Israel against Hamas. How is this war, first or foremost, a war of information and framing, aside from everything that's going on the ground?
Yeah, well, that's a really good question. And it certainly is an information war. There's an old adage that in wartime, the first casualty is the truth. And I think you've seen that both in Ukraine and in Gaza. So we have essentially two competing narratives, right? We have an Israeli narrative, one of self-defense, one of innocent victimhood, and you have an Arab-Palestinian narrative, which is one of, again, one of victimhood, one that highlights the damage done by Israelis and so on. And so you have these two completely different and competing narratives, not just in traditional media, but we've certainly seen this play out on social media as well. As I've spoken with journalists about covering this war and covering Ukraine as well, I think a couple of things that we need to be cautious about as journalists. One would be being very careful to avoid accidentally parroting propaganda, accidentally sharing mis and disinformation. So especially at the start of either war, at the start of the Gaza war especially, so many images that appeared online and even in traditional media were images taken from 5 or 10 years ago that were misused. I also think we need to be careful as peace journalists, as journalists, period, about a false equivalency. So certainly our focus should be on the humanitarian damage that's been done on both sides. So we should certainly highlight the 12 to 1400 Israelis who were killed, kidnapped, and so on October 7th. But we need to highlight as well the 34,000 Palestinians, at least that's the last figure I heard, the 34,000 Palestinians who have died in Gaza. And we must be careful to for our audiences to draw this distinction that 1,200 is not 34,000. And so there's a disproportionality here that we as journalists, I think it's our job to point that out. The Israelis might not like that very much, but 1,200 is not 34,000.
Yeah, I agree. The numbers aren't equal. I think when you go back to those different narratives, I think the narrative of the Israelis is then okay. If we don't, there might be a higher number on their side, but if we don't don't wage this war now, then our numbers might be even higher. And what we see now with Hezbollah, maybe they seem to be right. So it's immensely complicated to report on at an equilibrium here, especially in this case. No, I get it, absolutely. But
and let me mention as well how important context is. Yeah. Right. So when we're talking about Israel, Gaza, there are hundreds of years of context, yeah, and more recent context as well. That would, for example, a context that would discuss the blockade of Gaza, but context that would also discuss the raison d'etre of Hamas is the destruction of Israel, right? And so all of that context plays into it too. And I think that traditional media all too often focus on the superficial and don't do a sufficient job of bringing the context into the discussion.
Yeah, Absolutely agree. Still focusing just on the narrative, not about numbers or anything, but about the narrative. You mentioned that both sides have their own narrative that is playing against each other. Who do you think is winning this battle of narrative right now, and why would you say is the one having the upper hand against the other, maybe?
Well, I don't know that I would say that either side is winning the narrative. I think, I'll speak for the U.S., I think that both narratives have seeped into the public's consciousness. I do think there's a certain sympathy, there's a sympathy for Israel and what's happened to Israel, and you know, a feeling perhaps that Israel is defending itself. But on the other side, I mean, you've certainly seen the backlash on college campuses and elsewhere to American policy that supports Israel at all costs and provides the arms that have helped lead to these 34,000 deaths. So I don't know that I would say that one narrative or another predominates. And having spent most of the last year in Europe, my observation there would be the same as well. That there's an understanding that Israel is defending itself. But somewhere there's a line that many people feel that Israel has crossed.
Yeah. Talking about the receptions, those who receive those news and those who hear, listen to, or see those narratives, what can we as readers, listeners, or viewers of news about the ongoing war in Israel and Gaza, but any conflict for that matter, learn from you to get a broader, more nuanced and accurate picture of what's going on? How can we ourselves contribute to peace journalism from the receptionist side
So that's good. So what you say leads us to media literacy and the importance of media literacy. So, do we as media consumers, are we able to critically analyze the media content that we receive? Are we able to ask some key questions about who the sender is, about who the target audience is, about what purpose is behind the message, about what they want us to do or think or feel as a result of the message, and to be able as media consumers to look at the broader picture? So what are the objectives of this Russian disinformation? What are the objectives of information coming from the Israelis or the Palestinians? And so this field of media literacy has really exploded during the last 10 or 15 or 20 years. The understanding that fighting disinformation, that combating wartime propaganda isn't best done by pointing out individual stories and pointing out why and how they're wrong, but arming people with their own tools so they can do this themselves. Just ran into this in Moldova. So in Moldova, there's a breakaway republic called Transnistria that is Russian-dominated, Russian-speaking, and that hosts 1,500 Russian troops. So in Transnistria, Transnistria is a different world than Moldova. So Moldova's very European, has a European outlook. Transnistria is literally the last remaining outpost of the Soviet Union, not just attitudinally, but as you go into Transnistria, I was there about a month ago, there's a giant statue of Lenin towering over the town square, right? And so when I'm in Transnistria, I can't go in there and tell them, how can you believe this Russian propaganda?
Yeah.
Can't you see that this is obviously disinformation? That is not going to work. So instead of that, we talked about, so what are the messages that you're receiving? And why would the Kremlin present you with these messages. What can they hope to accomplish? And we'll do the same thing. We'll analyze messages from the West.
Yeah.
And I think from a media consumer standpoint, that's where the key lies. The key lies in the ability to critically think about the media messages that we receive, and to understand the bias, the disinformation, and the propaganda that are coming at us from all sides, from traditional media and now social media.
Yeah. Still something, I agree with you, absolutely. Still sometimes it can seem very difficult because you mentioned in the very beginning that to actively use and promote peace journalism, you have to focus on the wording and the framing, and especially the wording can sometimes be very subtle. So why does he use this word to talk about a certain topic and not the other word that everybody else is using? And this sometimes is very hard to detect, and sometimes it slowly seeps into society, becomes the standard. Like recently, I read that the term deep state in the United States, which originally meant something like a conspiracy, that there is a deep state within the government, like a government within the government that no one knows about. And recently I read an article, I don't know, in one of the big media outlets, I think CNN or something, and they used deep state as a regular term, as if this is like, yeah, deep state, this exists, and it's that exactly, and it's not a conspiracy. So my question would be, how can we be aware of, especially of the wording or of certain frames, how can we become more aware of this, and is it possible for us to even avoid those bad frames, bad wordings altogether?
See, I think that's the role of the peace journalist. Exactly the role is to make the public aware of these terms. So if CNN was using deep state, was somehow normalizing deep state, shame on them. Because this is
Was CNN. So
Whoever it was, shame on them. Because a deep state is a right-wing propaganda term by Trump to describe the American government bureaucracy, and it's a pejorative term because Trump and his allies don't like anything that might check his power. Unless they used it in that context, shame on them. But I think it's the role of the peace journalist to point out these terms and to help their readers and listeners understand the absurdity of these terms. So in Moldova, Transnistria, when I was in Transnistria and we were discussing the Ukraine war, several of the journalists I was meeting used the term special operation.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which is Putin propaganda for the Ukraine war.
Yeah.
And of course, the minute I heard that term, first of all, my head almost exploded. But as soon as I calmed down, we talked about what that means.
Yeah.
And we broke down the definition of the word war. And by the end of the discussion, small victory for me, they admitted, okay, this is a war. That special operation is nonsense, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Nonsense isn't limited to the Russians. So way before our time, during the Korean War was at times called a police operation by the UN.
Yeah.
Well, nonsense. This isn't arresting a few vandals. This was a war, a full-scale, outright war. And so that sort of nonsense. Linguistic nonsense that we want to highlight.
Yeah, but then someone comes along and says, no, it can't be a war because war has to be cleared by Congress. And as long as Congress doesn't say it's a war, it's not a war. It's a conflict or a police operation.
Yeah, I mean, we heard that from Vietnam too.
Exactly.
Nonsense. Yeah, ask anyone who fought in Vietnam. This a police action? It's war. By every reasonable definition, it's a war.
Absolutely. No, I'm not arguing against it. Just stating the counter argument there.
Absolutely.
But on the other hand, what you're explaining about peace journalism, this all sounds very reasonable, but it also sounds very complex and complicated. So my question would be, and it's maybe a question that a lot of media outlets and newspapers ask themselves before putting out any news these days, does it sell? Not in a monetary way, but in a way, will people read it? Will people click on it? Will people like it? Will people share it in their social media feed? So does or can peace media, can peace journalism, can it sell? Does it sell? And has it a chance to succeed? Or is it just, it's a nice thought, but it's too complicated and no one will listen anyway?
Okay, that's the million-dollar question, right? So, I mean, I do see peace journalism as aspirational and acknowledge that it's difficult to implement. And the obstacles are different from place to place to place. But that said, we as journalists and aspiring journalists have been taught forever that we need to make our stories flashy, sensational, that we need to use images and words that grab the audience's attention.
Yeah,
I was taught this in journalism school a million years ago, back when dinosaurs ruled the earth, and they've been teaching it forever, right? Peace journalism's answer to that is a very simple, yes, people do and will pay attention to peace journalism. Research done by Professor Jake Lynch at the University of Sydney. Worldwide research. He went to 5 or 6 different countries and showed different versions of the same story. A traditional media version and a peace journalism version. Some of these were written stories. Some of them were video stories, television news stories. He did questionnaires. He did focus groups. His methodology is very solid. Professor Lynch is a world-renowned academic. And what he found was that audiences prefer peace journalism style stories over traditional news. Why? Traditional news often leaves audiences feeling disempowered, feeling depressed, feeling hopeless, feeling angry. And I think that these feelings are one of the reasons why we see a record amount of news avoidance. So news avoidance, people simply not choosing to not consume news because they hate what they're reading or seeing and the way that it makes them feel.
Yeah.
Peace journalism, on the other hand, leaves audiences feeling better informed and empowered to seek and discuss solutions to these kinds of stories. And so there's really solid evidence that shows that audiences prefer peace journalism style stories. Now, we need to get this research in the hands of every editor in the world, right?
Yeah.
Because certainly this evidence produced by Professor Lynch goes against the conventional wisdom, which is if it leads, it bleeds, you have to make it sensational and so on. And that's simply wrong.
Very fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. I hope more people will read this study and act accordingly. But now we come to our last question, and we shift the focus a little bit away from media and news and more to the basic topic that is communication. In the beginning, I said that we always and at any time communicate with one another. More often than not, we are unaware of how we do that, But like Paul Watzlawick said, we cannot not communicate. So what advice would you, as a former professor of communications and promoter of peace journalism and peace media, give people, especially young people, who want to live in a more peaceful world, on how to communicate more peacefully or towards more peace?
So let me talk to young people. The first thing I would say is put down the phone and actually consume some traditional media. Look at newspapers and magazines and television broadcasts. Listen to public radio and so on. Because a lot of the information they receive on social media is bad or incomplete. A recent study was done here in the U.S., that involved giving news quizzes to media consumers. And to no one's surprise, the media consumers who consume traditional media, newspapers, television, radio, and so on, scored much, much higher on the news quiz than those who depend on social media for their news. So my first advice to young people is consume traditional media. Because a lot of what you're getting on social media is, pardon the non-academic term, crap. Second advice I would give to young people is to practice peace media themselves. To look at what they produce, what they create, and what they share on social media. Is what they create and produce, is it creating an atmosphere that's conducive to peace? Is it stereotyping? Is it discriminatory? Is it hate speech? Does it further politically polarize? Or does it unite people? So I would encourage young people and everyone to be more cognizant of their online lives, what they create, what they share, and analyze what your online social life. Am I contributing to peace or am I contributing to conflict?
Professor Youngblood, thank you very much for this very interesting conversation. I hope you will reach more people, more journalists with your seminars and workshop. Thank you very much for answering my questions today. And let's hope for a more peaceful world. Thank you.
You've been very kind. It's been my pleasure.